bit more technical results. Now, they are not very technical. It's just that they will have a bit more equations. I'll spend the time to try to explain them properly. No? So basically, this talk is organized as follows. First, I will describe a bit more precisely what we mean by tensor models. I will briefly describe the Marvin expansion. I will discuss a bit the continuum limits, and then I will draw some conclusions. So as you've all seen, I will start with the most technical transparency in Vincent's presentation. You know, tensor invariants are related to edge-colored graphs. And well, this goes as follows. You know, the building block of our theories are tensors, which transform independently on this each index. So we have a distinct unitary. And we are building, you know, out of these tensors, we build invariant quantities. And the invariants, you know, they are represented by these colored graphs, where you know, the vertices, black and white, represent the tensors, T and T bar. And the edges, they represent contractions. For instance, this one is an identification of the first index on T with the first index on T bar here, and so on. So now, having this basis to describe all the invariants, you know, a tensor model, it is a field theory. So it is defined by an action. So we are interested in an action which is, it has here an invariant, you know, which has all, an invariant part, which has all invariants with at least four tensors. So everything which is four or six or whatever, I just consider invariants, and I put them here in the interaction part. And to each invariant, I associate some coupling constant. And then, well, for the quadratic part, now, for the remainder of this talk, I will just choose the simplest possible thing, you know, namely, again, an invariant. So we have a unique quadratic invariant. I have a T, a T bar, and all the indices are contracted. So this is what I'll use from now on as quadratic part. Now, this can be modified, you know. We remain in the frame, in the same framework, and we get the same kind of results if here we add some non-trivial kernel. So I still identify indices, the first one on T with the first one on T bar and so on, but I can put here eventually some function which depends on the specific values of the indices. So this is what happens in the tensor field theories Vincent mentioned. Now, how do you get from this to group field theories? Well, you could consider that these indices, you know, instead of being in U1, you know, they can, you know, live in a SU2 group or something. You can put a kernel which implies, which includes some invariance, some what you call gauge invariance and so on. So basically, relating these models to GFTs and so on just comes to modifying the quadratic part. Now, we are interested, you know, because it's a field theory, in computing the partition function and correlation functions. So the partition function, it's an integral over the tensor entries T and T bar exponential minus some scaling factor times this action. So the scaling factor has to do with the size of the tensors of the indices, and this is like the appropriate scaling. No? Turns out that, in fact, you know, all the factors of N you'll be seeing in this talk are canonical, so you cannot tweak with them. You can't choose different scalings. You know, things work only if you choose this kind of scaling. Now, in order to evaluate a partition function or a correlation function, one performs usually an expansion in Feynman graphs. So in the Feynman graphs, you know, the vertices are these guys here. You know, if I expand Taylor expand in T in the coupling constants, these traces, these invariants will act as vertices. So if I want to compute the amplitude of a graph first, you know, I get these effective vertices, which I draw here as graphs with D colors, you know? And then I need to compute a Gaussian integral of these insertions. Now, recalling that the invariants are polynomials, you know, these insertions have T and T bars here. So how do I compute a Gaussian integral? Well, a Gaussian integral is evaluated in terms of weak pairings. So I need to represent these pairings of tensors, you know, in some way on my graphs. And because it's a weak pairing, it's a new kind of edge I need to represent on the graph. So every weak pairing will be represented by such a dashed line, you know, to which I'll associate a color zero. So you see that whereas the invariants themselves, they are graphs with D colors, the Feynman graphs, which evaluate partition function or the correlation functions of these models, have one extra color. Now, these graphs with one extra color, in fact, are related to triangulations. And I will present a bit in detail how this relation goes. So why do these invariants represent triangulations? We said that it has to do with geometry. Well, this comes about as follows. Now, the graphs, they have black and white vertices, and they are connected by edges, which have colors, and they have D colors from the invariants, and one extra color coming from the V construction. So they have D plus one colors. Now, each colored graph like this, with vertices and colored edges, is dual to a triangulation. Namely, to each vertex, I associate a D simplex. So in this particular case, where I chose 3 plus 1 colors, the vertices are dual to tetrahedra. And the edges, you know, they are dual to the triangles bounding the tetrahedron. Now, the edges have colors, so the triangles bounding the tetrahedron have colors. For instance, there I have the triangle of color 3. Back there is the triangle of color 1, and so on. And this coloring of the edge of the triangles which bound the tetrahedron induces colorings. Induces colorings on all the other things which compose my tetrahedron. For instance, there is a unique edge in this tetrahedron which is common to the triangles 1 and 3. So I'll associate to this edge the color 1, 3, and so on. Vertices are also colored, and so on. Now, an edge in a color graph represents the unique gluing of two simplices which respects all the colorings. So I will always glue a triangle of color 3 on a triangle of color 3 such that the edge of color 3, 1 is glued on the edge of color 3, 1, the one of color 3, 0 is glued on 3, 0, and the one of color 3, 2 is glued on 3, 2. So a color graph encodes completely a unique, well-defined gluing of these simplices. Now, having understood that a graph with D plus 1 color, it's a triangulation in D dimensions, so in particular for 3 plus 1 colors, this is a three-dimensional triangulation, one could ask, OK, what does an invariant represent? So an invariant has one less color. It doesn't have the color 0. So automatically, it will represent a triangulation in one less dimensions. So an invariant will represent a D minus 1 dimensional triangulation, which is a boundary triangulation. Now, on the other hand, invariants arise as subgraphs in Feynman graphs. So as subgraphs, you know, they are this subgraph here with color 1, 2, 3 connected to the rest of the graph by the edges of color 0. So as I told you, each vertex, you know, in a Feynman graph represents a simplex. So such an invariant, in fact, represents the gluing of these simplices around the central vertex. So it represents a chunk. You know? So every invariant as a subgraph is a chunk. And by itself, it represents a boundary. Well, this boundary is exactly the boundary of this chunk, which I drew here in green. So an invariant has a double interpretation, first of all as boundary, and second of all as building block, you know. And a graph, it's a gluing of these building blocks together to give a space. Now, all this is, you know, this triangulation, you know, I should insist, it's a combinatorial triangulation which is encoded in these colors, you know. So for now, I have not said anything about the metric in this triangulation. It's just a combinatorial triangulation, topological object. Okay. So what is the general framework? What are the observables of our models, you know? So as a field theory, you compute expectations of observables. The observables are the invariants themselves. So they are boundary triangulations. So my observables are boundary triangulations. And the expectations, well, this comes that evaluating some integral with insertions here and the action, we've weighted by the action. So these are boundary states. And in fact, an expectation sums over Feynman graphs, which are D plus 1 dimensional triangulations, so they are bulk triangulation. And such an expectation sums over all bulk triangulations which are compatible with the boundary triangulation. So this, it's a state sum model which sums over all possible ways to connect to boundary triangulations by a bulk. Now, for instance, you know, if I look just at the expectation of one boundary, you know, this is a boundary to vacuum, you know, the B to vacuum amplitude, I can look at the connected expectation of two boundary states. So this is a transition amplitude between the boundary states B1 and B2, you know, and this is a sum over all possibilities to fill this with some bulk. Okay. Now, several remarks are in order. First of all, you know, the fact that here I have a path integral automatically fixes everything, you know, so this formula is uniquely defined by the path integral. The Feynman weights are defined of each graph, the combinatorial weights. The amplitudes are uniquely defined, so this is a canonical prescription, you know, which gives me a precise answer for this correlation. So my purpose from now on will be to evaluate this and compute these correlations between boundary states. Now, second of all, what is the weight of a triangulation? Well, as I said to you, every graph is a triangulation. It's a combinatorial triangulation. And the weight, well, I can choose it in several ways. You know, it's a function of what I put in my quadratic part and what particular groups I choose and so on. It can be related to Weinstein-Hilbert. It can be BF. It can even be more complicated, you know. So the weights of the triangulation are discretized actions. But I can implement several choices, you know, to see what I obtain. And last but not least, you know, this is a sum over triangulations which connect the boundaries. So triangulations are discretizations. They are not continuum geometries. So in order to go from this sum over triangulation to a sum of to something continuum, I need to do something. You know, I can't just stop at evaluating one or two graphs. You know, I need to do something. And we'll see further down the road what we need to do. OK. Now, a very technical transparency, what is a non-perturbative result and why do we care? Well, suppose that we are interested in computing something. In particular, for this model, we are interested in computing expectations, you know? So if I want to compute interesting quantity, you know, a non-perturbative result is something which concerns the full interesting quantity. So it usually stated like some explicit function, which I can evaluate, you know, plus a rest term, And this is what makes it a non-perturbative result, rest term respects some bound. So I need to be able to say something about the rest, you know? Now, this formula here is the counterpart of what experimentalist tells us, that in principle, when I measure something, I get a measured value and an error bar. So this rest smaller than good bound is plays the part of the error bar. Now, why is this important? Well, because if I evaluate the explicit part, I get a good approximation of the interesting quantity, meaning that, you know, the difference between these two, it is small up to terms of the order of good bound. So I always need to ask myself, you know, what is the bound I can establish on the rest? You know, how close I am to the full result when I give you some explicit thing, you know? So, of course, this is not the case if I do not have a good bound on the rest. So I always need at least, you know, to think about the rest, you know? If I'm not even asking myself, you know, what should I do about the rest? You know, what I compute is at best naive or at worst even can be completely off. So this being said, let's compute some quantities, you know, and see what we get, you know? So it turns out that in these models, you know, I have a whole class of them, so I'll just fix on a simpler one. So the simplest one is, you know, some action with invariance in this quadratic part, you know? I'm interested in expectations, in correlation of boundary states. And, well, as interactions, I'll just choose the simplest I could think of. So these are just quartic interactions, which just involve four tensors, you know, so they are the lowest degree things I can put in. And moreover, the indices are contracted in a very simple fashion. So my tensors I divided in, you know, two pairs, you know, two up there and two down here. And all but one indices are contracted in a pair. And I have one index which is transmitted. So as a function of this, of the color of this index which is transmitted, I can get several possible interactions. So I will just weight, you know, all of them with the same coupling constant. So now instead of having here many coupling constants, I will just have one coupling constant for this invariance and zero for all the others. So this is the simplest quartically perturbed measure I can think of. And as I told you, I'm computing expectations of observables. I will choose the simplest observable. So it's the expectation of an invariant, and the invariant in question, it will be just the quadratic invariant. So the n here, it's, you know, chosen for scaling purposes, you know. So I will just concentrate now in telling you what I can say about this expectation computed with this simplest model with these coupling constants here. So there are several levels at which I can make statements about this correlation function. So first of all, let's try to give a small interpretation. You know, what does this model describe? You know? So it's a very simple model. It's the simplest you can think of. And well, if I expand in the parameter lambda, I get a sum over graphs, as you've seen. And this graph has an amplitude. Now, it turns out that I can rewrite this amplitude, you know, in something related to the dual triangulation. And namely, what I get is that from the point of view of the dual triangulation, the amplitude of a graph, it's exactly, you know, has the form of a dynamical triangulation model. So it has a coupling constant, which depends on the lambda and the size n of the tensor, you know, times the number of d minus 2 simplices in my triangulation minus the another coupling constant times the number of d simplices. So this is the form of a discretized Einstein-Hilbert action on the, you know, dual triangulation with equilateral triangles. So in this very simplistic model, what we describe, it's a dynamical triangulation model. Okay. So what can we say about this observable? Now, I'm concentrating on it because I can write nice explicit formulas, but you should understand that what I'm saying can be generalized to any correlation. So about any correlation between boundary states, I can make the similar kind of statements. So the first level statement is that, okay, I have two parameters, lambda and n. I perform a Feynman expansion in lambda. So I can tell you that this two-point function, it's some explicit terms, you know, of order lambda plus others, which represent other graphs, which are at least order lambda square. Now, this is, you know, a Feynman expansion, and it suffers from a lot of problems, you know. So first of all, the terms here can be from the same order of magnitude from the point of view of large n, you know, with this term before. So this is not a very good splitting. Now, second of all, you know, you say, okay, they are still smaller because they have more powers of lambda, but this series is difficult to control, you know. I cannot really put a good bound on this. So the interesting quantity K2 is not well expressed in this form, you know. My rest term, I have no way to put a good bound on it. Now, one thing which we have been able to do is to obtain a 1 over n expansion, which comes at writing this quantity K2 as some explicit formula, depending on lambda, plus a rest term. Now, this explicit formula, if you see, in fact, it's a series in lambda, so it's certainly much more than terms, you know, of it has terms of arbitrary high powers in lambda, you know. So I have these explicit terms, and how about the rest term? In this one over an expansion, I can show you that each individual amplitude here, it is smaller from the point of view of large n. So the leading order is just n to the power 0. Everything which follows has at least a suppression 1 over n to the power d minus 2. So uniformly, you know, all these guys are certainly small. Now we can do even better than this, in fact, much better than this, you know. So we can establish a non-perturbative expansion. This means what? I can write you this two-point function as some explicit terms, you know, so the first one is just coincides with the one there, but then I can also write explicitly up to a certain order, and then the rest term, well, for the rest term, I can show that it is, in fact, a function which depends on the coupling constant, that it is analytic in a certain domain in the complex plane, you know, and supports a good bound, meaning that it is suppressed in large n, n in small lambda. Now, I just want to take a moment, you know, to explain some things. First of all, to get this kind of bound is not easy. You know? So it's not just naively taking the pass integral and, you know, resumming graphs and so on. Some of the graphs diverge. So one needs to be much smarter than this and much needs to employ a lot of techniques, you know, which come from, you know, constructive field theory, which comes to reorganizing the Feynman series in a different way, the explicitly deriving the first terms and so on, and keeping always at any step the rest under control. So first of all, you know, this is not easy. Second of all, this is an interesting feature. This rest term includes, if I start to develop it perturbatively, the sum over all other graphs. So there are some graphs which I explicited here, and this is a repackaging of the sum over all other graphs. Now, why it is relevant is because it encodes, for instance, the sum over all possible topologies. So this rest term controls completely the sum over all topologies. It is bounded in a good way. You know? So I can perform this manipulation. It is not easy, but it can be done. You know? So in some sense, you know, this is the kind of the state of the art you can get with a prediction. You really have a good rest term with a good bound on it. Okay. Now, having seen, you know, precise results we can get concerning this K2 function, how can we go beyond it? You know, so you see that the rest terms are suppressed in 1 over n. So one idea would be to take an n to infinity limit, and this will lead us to a continuum limit. So because I have the good bound, the rest term goes to 0 when I send n to infinity. You saw that it was suppressed in large n. So then the limit, so this is a mathematical statement, the limit when n goes to infinity of this two-point function is this particular expression. So what does this teach me? Well, it teaches me a number of things, you know. First of all, it teaches me that because here I have an infinite series in lambda, this represents a sum of an infinite family of graphs. So I can start looking and see what kind of graphs do I get, and turns out that all these graphs have spherical topology. They are relatively simple spheres, you know, and they are called Mellons. Now, second of all, this function here exhibits a critical behavior. Namely, you see that if I lambda goes close to minus 1 over 4d, the argument of this guy becomes small, and I pick up a square root behavior. You know? So in the critical regime, I pick up a critical behavior. And in fact, if I look carefully, this critical behavior comes from the fact that, you know, the series expansion here has a certain radius of convergence. So in the critical regime, tuning lambda to this value means that I approach the convergence radius of this series. So as usual, when I approach the convergence radius of a series, large term in a Taylor expansion start to dominate. This is why the series starts to diverge. So in this regime, the large graphs dominate, and namely the infinitely refined graphs, which have represent triangulations with an infinity of simplices, they dominate. So this is, in fact, a continuum limit. What I get here, it's a random space, a continuum random, infinitely refined random space in this continuum limit. Now, we are very happy. We see a continuous random geometry emerging, but as Van San already, you know, disclosed to you in the last talk, turns out that, well, after some studies, you can conclude that this emergent geometry is a branch polymer. So now the question is, what do we do with this, you know? Now, the first attitude would be, try a different approach. You know, as you've seen these models, this particular model has to do with dynamical triangulation. So you could say, OK, I'll take dynamical triangulation seriously, but I will restrict my sum over triangulations by a condition like CDT condition or something. You know, I cannot generate this by a pass integral anymore, but, you know, I can study numerically and so on. So that is, of course, one attitude and can lead to some, you know, consequences. Now, a second attitude is, OK, I just presented you the simplest model one could think of, so I can do better than this. I can start to introduce holonomies, change the propagator, put simplicity constraints, you know, or whatever, you know. This leads to the road to GFT and so on and so forth. You know, so this, you know, it's like the advantage of this, you know, so this might change the critical behavior. The you know, going to a CDT setting. Now, the second one will presumably not change the critical behavior, but it will change the metric interpretation. Because I explained to you that this model looking at the amplitude of a graph resembled a dynamical triangulation weight of a triangulation, using different data, encodes the metric differently. So even if combinatorially my melon looks like a branch polymer is very spiky, in fact, because the metric is hidden in the group elements and so on, it can be very different geometrically from a branch polymer. So this is also a way out. Well, and another possible way out, which is the one I will take in the next slide, it's in fact to take this seriously, you know, and to understand what happens precisely at this phase transition. So we saw a first phase transition, you know, which is tuning this lambda to criticality, but this can be studied in more detail. And how does that happen? Well, you do it by what we call a double scale. So the hope being that in double scaling, you know, we'll find some nicer looking spaces and not these spiky ones. But I repeat, this is very dependent on the interpretation, metric interpretation of my data I put on my theory. Okay, so very briefly, what is a double scaling? Well, it's a beautiful thing, you know. So it turns out that I can reorganize my series, you know, again, as an explicit part plus a rest term. So the explicit part, you know, which I identified here, can take this form, and I can isolate here some other things. This is, again, a sum over graphs. And notice that, you know, these graphs have arbitrary large power, suppression powers in N. So this is a way to go and pick up contributions from triangulations which are very much suppressed, you know. Now, so far, you know, this is uninteresting because I haven't told you anything about the rest, you know. Well, it turns out that, you know, if now I take this variable here and I call it X, you know, which is exactly the denominator here, you know, and I pass from lambda to X, I change from lambda to X, the rest term for a fixed X, it's suppressed in N with respect to the leading order. You see that here I have only one half, and here I have a full one. So this splitting, in principle, doesn't do anything, but it is useful if I fix X and I look at large N. So this is called a double scaling limit, and this particular scaling has been first inferred by these three gentlemen here. I will send N to infinity and lambda to criticality, because, you know, sending N to infinity keeping X fixed automatically glues lambda to criticality, but in a controlled way. So I send lambda to criticality in a controlled way, and in this way, the rest term is suppressed, so I can just forget about it, and I get a new double scaled formula for the K2. In this double scaled formula, I have again graphs which contribute, so I get a larger family of graphs because they correspond to things which are arbitrarily suppressed initially. So I get some larger family of graphs, larger than the melonic ones, which contribute. No? Now, this particular scaling, in fact, works for D less than 6. In D higher than 6, I have another double scaling which works, but, you know, let's just concentrate on the simplest one. And we already see, you know, that it is possible to go beyond the melonic phase by fine-tuning my approach to criticality. You know, the just going like a bulldozer to criticality gives me these melons, but if I fine-tune it, I can discover fine structure effects. So I'm reaching the conclusions of my talk. First of all, you know, what have we learned, you know, from Van Sant's talk and maybe what I presented to you today is that we actually have a framework to study random discrete geometries, you know. So the framework we have presented has a pass integral formulation, so hence it gives me a canonical way to sum over triangulations. It has built-in scales which are given by the size of this tensor, you know. It sums over discretized geometries because the graphs represent combinatorial triangulations. Now the weights, well, we've seen an example where, you know, for a very naive model, they represented discretized by Einstein-Hilbert action, you know, and believe me, we can do BF on much more, you know. And this framework, because it's a pass integral formulation, allows us, in fact, to even give non-perturbative predictions. Because I have this pass integral formulation, I can, in fact, control my rest terms at all steps, you know. So this is kind of encouraging, you know, when I'm telling you that A equals B plus small, believe me, it's small. So, of course, you know, a question is space truly discrete? So we heard a lot of debate about this, you know, should we have an ultimate cutoff of Planck-like or not? Well, the answer is that, you know, we don't know, but it doesn't matter. As Lee was mentioning, you know, even if the universe has a fundamental discreteness, it certainly has a lot of degrees of freedom. So even if it has a fundamental discreteness, it must be composed of a lot of quanta. So I do need, under any circumstances and in any scenario, to go to a highly refined phase of a triangulation. And this is indeed, it can be done in these particular models by tuning to criticality where I find infinitely refined phases. And moreover, fine structure effects can be explored by tuning the approach to criticality. Now, what would you call a prediction of this model? Well, as I presented the framework and I took a particular model, I did not tell you this should be gravity, and I don't know which model will describe gravity. So at least in the beginning, one should concentrate on universal predictions. So what are universal predictions? You know, there are generic features. For instance, generically, we do obtain a continuum highly refined phase by tuning to criticality. Generically, we do explore fine structure effect by tuning. Generically, we do get certain numbers, certain critical exponents, which are, you know, repeat themselves across several models. This is what I would call generic predictions, you know, of these models, you know, not the particular form of K2. You know, the two-point function in this model had an explicit formula that was nice, but that's not a prediction. You know, that's just an, you know, happened to be for this model like this. Okay, so finally, you know, we've been able to do much more than what I presented today with tensor models and GFTs, and for this I invite you to go to the session, you know, tomorrow. And, well, we have still a lot to do, you know. As Vincent was saying, we are just a toddler, so we still need a lot of help to explore these models. And I just list here a list of open questions, which are things which interest me most, you know. So this might look very mathematical. I'm interested in extending the non-perturbative results. Now, this is not so, you know, it's not just a technical issue. In fact, you know, if you look along the negative real axis for the coupling constant, we expect to have a cut. So we expect that our rest term cannot be continued, you know, in a domain which crosses this negative real axis. It should have a cut there. And usually, non-perturbative cut effects have to do with unitarity and of our model. If you want to extend, you know, on the other side of the, for the other side of the coupling constant. So this, they might play a true role, you know, in how we relate this theory with, you know, theories which have time in them or something. Second, well, of course, you know, now I've told you that we've been able to see something else than melons. So, you know, what do we see? So one should study this effective geometry. You start, again, ask the question of the Hausdorff dimension, of the spectral dimension, and so on. Now, as Vincent was mentioning, this, you know, continuum phase looks a bit like a confined phase. So it would be nice if we were able to find an adapted description, like an effective field theory, because, you know, presumably when you go to a phase transition, the initial theory is not very good at describing, you know, the theory under the phase transition. So that's also, you know, an important thing to see. Of course, you know, phenomenological implications and many, many other things. So.
Thank you for this vigorous lecture. Okay.
Thank you. So I would like to contrast this to two-dimensional gravity, because I have some intuition there about the old matrix models. So one thing there was that if you started with the Polyakov action and if you wanted to do this matrix model discretization or something like this, you always had this universal inverted harmonic oscillator. It's sort of, right? And then you basically had to fill up the levels and whatever. So do you have such a potential that it somehow has the universal features when you do this double scaling in your case?
So first, I'm not very familiar with the Polyakov action. I know something about matrix models, but more like matrix models and the
Polyakov
theory.
Let's say for you,
theory,
the relevant action might be Einstein-Hilbert action or something like this. But mm-hmm. basically, you know, you pick something, and that leads to a very particular potential that you want to have if you want to have a continuum limit devised through double scaling.
So what I can tell you is that we do have some universal results in single scaling. So if you send n to infinity, we get, in fact, a strong universal attractive behavior. In double scaling, we've just uncovered it, like recently. I mean, it was on the web on Monday. So we still have a lot to learn about the double scaling. It's there, we know it, but I will not start saying things about, you know, how universal it is, what exact kind of, you know, description, better description to this double scale phase I could give, and so on. So that's, you know, more for the future. I'm
Hey, Radvan. This is clearly a very beautiful and powerful result that you have. So one is immediately, you know, tempted to say, how can one use it strongly? And so I want to ask you a question which is related to what Lee was saying before, namely the Wilsonian point of view, which sort of inspired that, teaches us that there isn't much difference between a situation in which you have a cutoff taken to infinity and in which a situation in which you are simply looking at theory at a scale large with respect to some...
Yeah, as long as it's large enough with respect to the cutoff.
Right, there. So in this, if I take seriously your geometrical picture, right, you have this tetrahedra down there, this triangulation, then there are two ways of thinking physically about that. One is that if I have a piece of paper, inside here there are an infinite number of them, and the other there are roughly 10 to the what, 66 of them, because there is a Planck scale. What I would like to understand is that these results that you are presenting, which somehow screen to be want to be used, are necessarily attached to the idea that there is an infinite number of elementary, or not?
What they are attached to is the idea that there is certainly a large number of tetrahedra in the world, so I always need to go and look for system with a large number of degrees of freedom. So in order for this continuum limit to mean anything, I need to scale to criticality and get large numbers. You know? If I were to think that the universe is composed of roughly 3 tetrahedra, then all this would be useless. I could just do the usual Feynman expansion if you want. I would just stop at the first 3 graphs, that's the first 3 tetrahedra, and that's finished. So what you do need is to have a large number of tetrahedra. Now, as I was mentioning on the transparency before, if the fact that they are genuinely, if you want, of Planck length, or I really scale them to 0, after some point is not relevant, as long as I always look at phases where many of them contribute. So if I look at collective behaviors, I need to have many of them contributing. But it's not crucial for the final size of the tetrahedra to be exactly 0 or not. So.
Two short questions. First of all, in matrix models, when you sum over all genera, you actually probe all geometries in the continuum. Because
yes. But you don't really sum over all genera because it diverges. But anyways, yes.
No. You do double scaling limit and
it doesn't converge. Yes, it's not.
Okay, but you sum over all geometries, whether it converges or not. Let's not discuss it now. Now, in your model, how are you being ergodic on all matrices on all metrics in your target space?
So, if you look at the formula, so about this double scaling here. Wait, I'm going. I still get here arrested, So in matrix models, when you do the double scaling, you sum over everybody. Now you do have an issue, and for a mathematical physicist, it's a bit of an issue, the thing with the summation, but going beyond that, you certainly, when you do the double scaling, you don't get arrested here in matrices. Now here you do get arrested. What does this arrested compose of? It comprises of many things. It comprises of even spherical topologies, but which are triangulated in a sufficiently complicated way. It comprises of complicated topologies and so on and so forth. So this is a big, big mess, this rest here. So our double scaling leaves still a lot of things aside. Now, of course, you would wonder, so first, let's understand the part here, the leading part. But then, how can I try to access more of what I left in the rest? Well, if I saw that with respect to the single scaling, double scaling brought me something new but still left some rust, I can imagine that maybe I'm able to then to tune even better my approach to criticality and explore even better in the rest. So maybe you'll see me in 1 year from now telling you that I add here an y divided by n to some power and I explore even more triangulation. But most certainly for now, we leave here a lot of things aside,
Okay, thanks. The second question, you said that you have computed some universal critical exponents in your double scaling limit. Do they correspond to anything known? For example, people have been solving Ising model on random geometries and putting on the computer and computing indices.
So we do have some results for instance, this one half here in the two-point function, it is something which is relatively universal. It appears very often, some of them, so I can cite at least one critical exponent which corresponds to a numerical simulation by Ambjorn of Ising model in 3 dimensions numerical. And we obtain the same result analytically. But this one is not the case. This is no Ising model here. But this kind of one half, we recovered,
Let us thank the speaker again.